be here. I'd like to thank Daniel for inviting me. I'm really sorry that I will be leaving almost immediately. I've talked to you. Great time here and learned a lot of great stuff. So I'll be talking about how hard is quantum many-body theory. Obviously, quantum many-body theory is hard, but a lot of condensed matter physics, high energy physics, quantum chemistry is devoted to problems of finding ground states of quantum Hamiltonians. And I want to discuss how hard this problem actually is, discuss it from the standpoint of the computational complexity of the problem. And what we'll see is that entanglement in these quantum systems will be very important in determining the difficulty of the problem. Systems with a lot of entanglement will often be much more difficult to simulate than systems with a small amount of entanglement. This will be one of the major themes. So I'd like to thank Xiaogang Wen, Frank Verstrate, Toru Koma, and Sergei Brevi, who have been collaborators on various parts of this work that I'll be mentioning. So overview, I'm going to start by discussing various algorithms that people use to simulate quantum many-body systems. Perturbation theory, a very standard approach. DMRG, density matrix renormalization group, or more generally, so-called matrix product algorithms. I'm going to spend a fair amount of time talking about these because these are a very important class of algorithms that really show you how systems with small entanglement can be simulated efficiently, while ones with a lot of entanglement are very tough to study. And talk briefly about exact diagonalization. And as I said, I'll be talking a lot about different computational complexity classes. And then I'm going to go through various problems in quantum many-body theory and relate them to different computational complexity classes. So you have sort of easy problems, problems which you can do in polynomial time or close to polynomial time, such as perturbing a system, starting with a known Hamiltonian and perturbing it in some way. And in many cases, you can do this efficiently, and you can find efficient representations of the ground state. Harder problems are going to include gapped systems in 1D, one-dimensional quantum systems which have a gap between the ground state and the first excited state. And here, I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about quantum entanglement, because area laws, which will be laws that bound the amount of entanglement in these systems, imply that there exist efficient representations of the ground state. They don't tell us how to find them, but they tell us that we can efficiently represent the ground state of these systems on an ordinary classical computer without too much work. And then I'll very briefly mention at the end some very hard problems, problems in one dimension where there is no spectral gap, which Daniel Gottesman played a key role in working on recently, which there probably is no efficient way at all of solving these problems on a classical computer. So I'm going to be talking about a range of different problems in quantum many-body theory of increasing difficulty and discuss how the entanglement relates to the difficulty of solving these problems in quantum many-body theory. So I'll begin with some algorithms that people commonly use in practice. Exact diagonalization is one such algorithm. So what you do here is you just take the Hamiltonian that you want to find the ground state of, and you go exactly diagonalize it. You use sparse matrix techniques to find the ground state of this Hamiltonian. The trouble is that the computational cost of doing this will grow very rapidly in the size of the system. The dimension of the Hilbert space, if these are a system of spins, if you have, say, spin a halves or qubits, then the dimension of the Hilbert space will be 2 to the size of the system. And even just to find the ground state, typically one can do around 30 to 40 spins. You really just get limited by memory, and you can't do any bigger than that, no matter how long you spend. So it works well, but it works only for very small systems. Another kind of common approach is perturbation theory. You say, let's suppose we have a Hamiltonian that can be written as some known part, H naught, that has a simple ground state that we can explain that we can describe very simply. Say H naught might be a non-interacting system in some. And then you add a perturbation. You add some perturbation V with a strength lambda, and lambda is small. Then you can try to describe the ground state of this new Hamiltonian by perturbing about the ground state of the old Hamiltonian and seeing how the ground state changes. So I've just written down here the first couple terms of a perturbation series for the ground state energy. And various perturbation theory algorithms involve different ways of computing these terms. In physics, there are Feynman diagrams. In quantum chemistry, you have Muller-Plessy. There are issues to do with convergence of the series. But this works well if this interaction lambda is weak. But when the interaction becomes strong, this does not work well. Finally, I'd like to mention matrix product methods, and including DMRG. DMRG is an example of a matrix product methods. So all of these methods are based on a particular ansatz for the ground state. I'm going to be spending a lot of time talking about this ansatz for the ground state and explaining why this might be a good ansatz for the ground state in a quantum system. So we have, let's say I have a system of spins. I'm going to label them spin 1, spin 2, spin 3, up to spin n.
And I need to write down the wave function of these spins. So it's going to be some psi of S1, S2, S3. And this is a particular ansatz for the wave function. So if these are spin ones, each of these spin variables will go minus 1, 0, or 1. If they're spin half, it'll be minus a half or a half. But this is the wave function I need to write down. And the ansatz that people use in these matrix product methods is as follows. You introduce a set of auxiliary variables called bond variables, which I'll label by alpha, beta, gamma, delta. I'll use Greek letters for these bond variables. These will range from 1 up to k. K is some parameter called the bond dimension. What's going to happen is that k determines how big a variational class we're talking about. When k is large, we have a very large class of states to vary over, but it's a lot of work. When k is small, we don't have such a big class of states to vary over, but we can do it much more easily. So the bigger k is, the broader this class of matrix product states is. And we introduce some matrices. And these matrices are the variational parameters in this matrix product state. So I'm going to label the matrices A1, A2, A3. And then these indices, A1 of alpha beta, that's the alpha beta, the alpha-th row and the beta-th column of this matrix A1. And then I have this thing here and so on. And I sum over all these bond variables. What this is this is precisely a product of all of these matrices. And I should mention, sorry, when I introduce these matrices, for each site, I introduce a number of matrices that depends upon the number of values of this spin, SI. So this matrix depends upon the spin on the site. So in the spin a half case, I introduce 2 matrices for each site. In the spin 1 case, I introduce 3 matrices for each site. So then the variational parameters are these. So the state is determined by there's a question.
One-dimensional system, so there's a chain.
At this point, this is a one-dimensional system.
Yes. Otherwise, would there be an algorithm for multiplying the matrices together?
There exists, in higher dimensions, there exists what are called tensor product states. One of the main troubles with using them is that there is not an efficient way of even normalizing the state, or then similarly computing expectation values of the state. Although they do seem quite promising in higher dimensions, but they're not as easy to manipulate as in one dimension. So in this case, the wave function is just a sum over all these bond variables, which is simply the trace of the product of these matrices. So for each site, you introduce the matrices. Then to determine the amplitude to have a given spin configuration, you just take the product of the matrices and then take the trace. Each of these matrices is k by k. So the number of variational parameters is n, because you have 1 on each site, times d. D is going to be the dimension here. In this case, it's 2, because there's 2 values for spin a half. In this case, it's 3, because there's 3 values for spin 1. So for each site, you have d different matrices. So you have n times d times k squared. That's the number of variational parameters in the problem that you have to vary over. There's a fair amount of redundancy that a lot of different matrices describe the same state. But that's the total number of parameters you can vary over. And this class of methods works extremely well for one-dimensional gap systems. And it actually even works very well for a lot of one-dimensional critical systems. And the question is, why? I mean, why is this a good ansatz for the ground state? And we'll see that this has to do with the amount of entanglements in the ground state. So I hope this class of matrix product states is clear, because I'll be talking about them a lot. So if anyone has some question about them, let me. Yes, I'll be getting to an interpretation. I just wanted to make sure the definition is clear. The interpretation, though, to jump ahead, is that the bond variables carry entanglement across cuts of the system.
Counts the number of sites that are interacting with each other. You call it as k.
So k is this is a range. These variables, alpha, beta, gamma, range from 1 up to k. I sum over all possible values of them.
But is there a physical meaning that they count the number of sites that interact with each other?
No. I mean, the meaning of the bond variable I'll discuss later. I just want to make sure the definition is clear, because the meaning I'll discuss a lot later. But the meaning of the bond variable is that that carries entanglement between the two halves of the system separated by that bond. And in states which are short-range entangled, for example, if you have a system of spin halves, as I drew, if the ground state just consisted of pairs of the spin halves formed into singlets like this, which is the ground state of some quantum spring chains, then the bond variable here would just mediate the entanglement between this singlet. This bond variable wouldn't have to do anything. This bond variable would mediate the entanglement on this singlet, and so on. More complicated states, you need to mediate more entanglement. So here you could do it with k equals 2. For more complicated states, you need larger k.
Are all of the, because you said it's either spin is one or spin one half, so do all of them have to be the same type of spin, or is
no,
it possible that
no,
I'm mixing
no,
it?
No, no, it may be different on each side.
And would the dimension be 5 then, or be 3 if you had 1 and 1 half together? Would the D, capital D, be 5?
If you had, on one side, you had a spin 1 and a spin a half? Is that what you're asking?
Well, if S1, S2 could either be spin 1 or spin a half. Like if you had,
how many states are there on the site? So D is just the number of states. So, okay. It can be. Okay. And now I'm just going to have a brief, I guess there's a lot of real computer scientists in the audience. So I've given this talk a bunch of times, usually when there aren't any computer scientists. And so when you mention complexity classes, then you always have to talk about this. But there are some real, many more computer scientists in the audience than I'm used to having. So I'll just go over this very briefly. But I want to talk about some, just briefly mention the notion of complexity classes, because I'll be talking about the different complexity classes that these quantum problems fall into. So first, you can talk about problems that you can solve in polynomial time on a classical computer. The time it takes goes polynomially in the problem size. So as an example, for example, sorting a list of n numbers. You can do that in a time that's polynomial in the length of the list. That's very easy to see. Finding the ground state of certain classical systems can be done in polynomial time. I just wrote one example there.
A very interesting one, relevant to this talk, is that if you want to simulate quantum dynamics, starting with some factorized state and evolving under a local Hamiltonian, you can do it for a time of order log n in an effort that's polynomial in n. You can't do it for a time that's polynomially long, but you can do it for a time of order log n in a time that's polynomial in n. And this relies a lot on locality properties of the Hamiltonian. This is an interesting example, something you can do quickly on a classical computer. If you want to simulate quantum dynamics for a time longer than this log n, for a time that scales polynomially in n, then what you would need is a quantum computer, at least as far as we know. So that's an example of probably the most important thing you would do in polynomial time on a quantum computer. Getting to a more difficult complexity class, and this will be relevant to these matrix product states, in fact, the class NP, this is a class of decision problems, where if
you're given a proof of some statements, and
if the answer is yes, you can check the proof rapidly. So as an example of a question, you take a classicalizing model. H is sum over I and j, jij, sigma I, sigma j, where each of these sigma I are plus or minus 1. And you ask, is there a choice of these sigma I being plus or minus 1? Is there a specific choice of them that gives a state with an energy E, a state with an energy less than or equal to E for some E? Can you find a state of energy less than something in this classical model? If the answer is yes, it's very easy to prove it's yes, because someone can just give you the spins, and you can very quickly check what's the energy of the state just by adding a few numbers. This problem is also so-called NP-complete. It's believed that if you could do this in polynomial time, then you could do every problem in NP in polynomial time. And it's believed then that this problem is not something you can do in polynomial time. And we'll see that the case of one-dimensional gapped quantum systems is going to fall into exactly this class, although it's not known to be complete for that class, but it falls into NP. Then the next class I want to mention is a class called QMA. QMA is again a class of decision problems, but these are ones where if the answer is yes, you can check the proof in polynomial time on a quantum computer, and with a caveat, with a probability, say, at least 2/3 of being right. The reason there's a probability now is that your quantum computer will have some, not always give the right answer, so you have to allow for some error, but let's say at least 2/3 of the time it's right. As an example of it, does a quantum Hamiltonian, rather than the classical Hamiltonian on the previous slide, but does a quantum Hamiltonian have a certain energy E or less for its ground state? And you have to be given a promise that if the energy is either less than some E or at least some small amount bigger than E, and if you're given this promise, the reason for this, I'll get to the reason for the promise, then this is something you can check quickly, because someone just gives you the state that's supposed to be the ground state, and you go measure the energy. The reason for this promise is you'll have a little bit of error when you measure the energy, and so you'll have a little uncertainty, so you can't measure it too accurately. And this problem is also QMA complete, in the sense that if you can solve it in polynomial time on a quantum computer, then you could do this for every problem in QMA, and that's believed to be impossible. And the history of these problems is interesting. It starts with Kitaev, but then much more recently, Daniel Gottesman, who's here, and then his collaborators and other people, showed that even one-dimensional systems are QMA complete if you ask questions of this form. So solving one-dimensional systems is actually a very hard problem if you don't assume the existence of a spectral gap. And this is going to be one of the key distinctions. I mentioned on the previously that if you know that there's a gap between the ground state and the first excited state, then these problems are only in NP. But if you don't know anything about a gap, then these problems are actually much, much harder of finding ground states of one-dimensional quantum systems. So here's just a belief sketch of how these different classes sit in relationship to each other as they get progressively harder. So let me now briefly talk about some of these quantum problems that you can do in some of these problems in quantum many-body theory that you can do in polynomial time on a classical computer or close to polynomial time, namely problems of perturbing a system. So here we have this perturbation theory, again, that I've written down. And in certain problems, you can compute the high-order coefficients fairly readily. If you talk about, if H-naught is very simple, if H-naught is a completely decoupled Hamiltonian, say you have a whole bunch of non-interacting spins, and each spin feels a magnetic field that wants it to point up. So H, and that's H-naught. There's no coupling between the spins. And then this V is some coupling between pairs of spins or triples of spins. Then you can compute the coefficients very rapidly. And the time to compute the mth coefficient goes exponentially in M. And at the same time, the error you make, assuming lambda is small enough, there's a radius of convergence to this, the error you make in only going up to mth order in the perturbation theory, that goes down exponentially in M. So the amount of work you have to do goes polynomially in the error. So for some of these systems, you can do the perturbation theory calculation very efficiently. And the effort you make is goes only polynomially in the error you want. If you talk about a more general problem, if this H-naught is not so simple, if it's actually an interacting system, not just decoupled spins, but spins that couple to each other, then it's harder to do the perturbation theory. But you can use a method called quasi-adiabatic continuation, which relies, again, on locality properties of the form I'll be discussing. And you can do it in a time that goes exponentially in a polynomial of the logarithm of the system size. So it's not quite polynomial in the system size, but it's still a lot better than exponential in the system size. So you can do perturbations in that case. So now let me start talking about really the meat of this, the matrix product state methods, and talk about entanglement in these things. So here again, I've written down this same matrix product state. I just wrote it down again. And now let's imagine cutting the system somewhere. This is a one-dimensional spin chain that I'm talking about. So let's imagine cutting the spin chain at some point into left and right halves. So here's the chain. Here are these bond variables, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and so on. And let's imagine a cut here and call this the left and the right half of the chain, left and the right half of the chain. So then that matrix product state can be written as, let's fix the value of that bond variable gamma that goes across the cut and sum over all the other bond variables, alpha and beta, which will be the bond variables on the left of the cut, and delta, epsilon, and so on, which are the bond variables on the right-hand side of the cut. Then what you find for a fixed value of gamma, after you sum over alpha and beta, that gives you some state on the left half of the chain. And then similarly, summing over this delta and epsilon and so on gives you some state on the right half of the chain. So I'll write this as psi left of gamma and psi right of gamma. So this matrix product state is now written in the form of psi matrix product state is the sum over this bond variable gamma going from 1 to k of psi left of gamma times psi right of gamma. So this is exactly what I meant. The gamma mediates the entanglement, and it's a state on the left and right half of the chain. Now, any state, though, can always be written, this is called a Schmidt decomposition, can always be written as a sum of states on the left and right half of the chain with some coefficients in this form. You can do this. So if this gamma ranges not from 1 up to k, but 1 up to 2 to the n, actually 2 to the n over 2, little bit sloppy, up to 2 to the n over 2, so actually even a slightly smaller number. So if you have an exponentially large number of the values of this gamma available, you can write any state as a state on the left-hand side of the chain, a state on the right-hand side of the chain, summed over this index gamma. But it may require an exponentially large value of gamma. And it's called the Schmidt rank, the number of such terms you need to express the state. So an arbitrary state may have a Schmidt rank 2 to the n, whereas a matrix product state has only a Schmidt rank k, which is much less than that. So the question is, how well can we really describe the ground state by this matrix product state? And what you need is that these A of gamma, these amplitudes, they have to decay rapidly with gamma. You need, if you ordered them from largest to smallest, you need them to decay very rapidly so that if you keep only the k biggest ones, because that's all you can have in the matrix product state, that you haven't made much error by throwing out the other ones. So you need a rapid decay of these things in order for these matrix product states to work well. A way of quantifying how fast this decay is by means of entanglement entropy. So now let me sketch this in more than one dimension, because this entanglement entropy is a more general concept than in one dimension. So let's imagine a system divided into subsystem A and B. Let's say A is some small region of the large system. And then you can, again, I just rewrite it once more, you can write your state psi naught as a sum of states on A, states on B, and some bond variable. I use now the index alpha instead of gamma, coupling them like that. And you can define an entanglement entropy, which is the sum over the value of this alpha, A alpha squared, that's the probability of having that particular state, times the log of that probability of having a particular state. So it's just a usual entropy. It's a probability times the log of the probability. And it can also be defined, instead of defining it via this Schmidt decomposition that I've done, you can define it more directly by density matrices. So if you want to do this calculation here, the entropy, what you'd have to do is take the state, find its decomposition in this form, and then sum over these to get this expression. You can do it directly in terms of the density matrices by saying you define rho to be the reduced density matrix on this region A. Rho is the reduced density matrix on region A, and S is minus trace rho log rho. This is the von Neumann entropy in this case. So for the matrix product state, this entropy S is at most log k, because there are at most k different possibilities that are there. And one of the questions is, well, how is the entropy of the ground state going to compare to this log k? If it's a lot larger than this log k, that means there are many more states needed to accurately represent the ground state than we have in the matrix product state. In fact, one can define other measures of the entanglement called Rainier entropies, which would be 1 over 1 minus alpha times the log of the trace of rho to the alpha. And as alpha goes to 1, in fact, this S of alpha goes to S. As alpha goes to 1, this denominator diverges, but then the log of the trace here goes to the log of 1 and goes to 0. And if you take the right limit, this becomes the same as this. So you have these Rainier entropies, and these are other measures of the entanglement. They are both measures of the entanglement. In this case, they measure slightly different things. The Rainier entropies for alpha bigger than 1 are very sensitive to the high probability events, the large A of alpha, whereas the ones with alpha less than 1 are more sensitive to the tails of this distribution A of alpha, how it decays at the tails. So it's, those will actually be quite useful. For an arbitrary state, if we just wrote down a completely arbitrary state off the top of our heads, you would expect that the entanglement entropy between these two would be of order the volume of A, would be of order the volume of A. For example, suppose each spin in A, say these are spin a half, each spin of A formed a singlet with one spin outside, then there would be 2 to the volume of A different states in A. They would be all equally likely, and there would be a large amount of entropy. An area law is a statement that the entropy is smaller. It's only of order the surface area of A, that only the stuff near the surface is contributing to the entropy. Let me give you the hand-waving argument for an area law. This argument is not correct, but this is the hand-waving one that you would see in the literature. The assumptions that go into the hand-waving argument are that you have a short-range Hamiltonian. So you have short-range interactions, that you have some unique ground state, and then you have a spectral gap to the first excited state. And so the hand-waving argument goes, well, you have a gap, which means that the correlations in the system will be short-range. The ground state will have only short-range correlations. Therefore, only the degrees of freedom near the surface of this region A, up there, only the ones near the surface, only the ones within the correlation length of the surface, will be entangled with the degrees of freedom in B. And then the area law, the entropy, will measure how many degrees of freedom in A are entangled with things outside A. And those will just be the ones near the surface, so they will be proportional to the surface area. So what goes wrong? Well, assuming that there is a gap in a short-range Hamiltonian, you can indeed prove that the correlations are short-ranged, but that is the only ingredient. There are exponentially decaying correlations in the system. I mean, this is not a surprise. It's a folk theorem for a long time, but one can actually prove that rigorously. However, even in one dimension, there exist states that have only short-range correlations but have huge amounts of entanglement. arbitrarily large. You can construct families of states with entanglements as big as you want, even though they have only short-range correlations. And this is based on quantum expanders. And this is actually why I got interested in quantum expanders, because these were a class of states with lots of entanglement but very small correlations. You may think of them as sort of a multipartite version of a data hiding state. So really, to prove an area law, one has to think about something more than the correlations in the system. Yeah?
For non-experts, what's a quantum expander? What's the physical reason why the intuitive thing fails for something?
A quantum expander will be a little hard to define quickly. But the intuitive reason is that if a spin, let's look at a spin deep inside this region A. Right? Some spin deep inside this region A, far away from the boundary. If you just measure the spin, it won't be correlated with anything else out here. There's no way in which it's correlated. And it even holds if you didn't measure just a single spin, but if you measured, some operator that acted on a couple spins. It's not just that it's one site. That still wouldn't be correlated with anything out here. But it might be the case that if you knew the state of all these guys near the boundary, then this guy would be strongly entangled with the things out here. And in fact, that's exactly what happens in these quantum expanders. That if you just know this state and this one, they will not be correlated with each other. But if you know the stuff in between, then these two will be correlated with each other.
This is something that involves 3-point or higher point correlations.
Right, but I also have this string stretching in between of additional stuff that I know. So it's not three points that are all far separated from each other. It's a region A, a region C, and a region B that just connects the two regions. And this region B is really mediating the entanglement between these two far separated regions, A and C. There is conditional mutual information between A and C in the presence of B. So
is B the quantum expander?
Okay, so a quantum expander is so you have this matrix product state that I've written up here. If you know the state of the system somewhere, let's say you know the state of the system here, all the way off to the left. Can you see that behind the transparency, the screen? You know the state of the system here, somewhere all the way to the left. Since it's a pure state, this means you know the state of the system at this cut going to the right, assuming you've measured it at the appropriate basis. However, let's say you don't get to measure this site, the first site here. Then you've lost some knowledge about the state of the system to the right. You have only imperfect knowledge about the state of the system here to the right. You have even less knowledge about the state of the system here further to the right, and so on. You get less and less knowledge as you move further and further over. That decay of knowledge is expressed in a completely positive map, and you can obtain that completely positive map from these matrices A. It's just these matrices A become the Krauss operators of that CP map. If that CP map is gapped, it expresses that there is this decay of correlations. So if you don't know about what happens on these intervening sites, then you've lost the correlation between here and here, because you've, exactly for the physics I've discussed, or mathematically, because that CP map has a gap. But if these matrices A are high dimension, there can still be large amounts of entanglement across all the cut. So the physics is that this state here is entangled with this one here, but only if you know the intervening states.
So there's an example of this in superconductivity. I have a magnetic flux.
There are no. I don't know any local ground state Hamiltonians that actually do this. This is to illustrate why you can't show that just because the correlations are short-ranged, the entanglement is small.
So this is not because the strings are conserved flux or something like that.
I know of no physical system that would do this. In fact, part of the proof of the area law is a very roundabout way of showing that physical systems won't actually do that as their ground state. But it shows you that it's to show that just because there's short correlations, then there can still be lots of entanglements. There's other reasons why there can't be lots of entanglements, which I'll get to. Yeah.
This might be an example in the other direction, but for black holes, this has been thought about. And even for a massless scalar field, you get an area law. So
yeah,
that would be a gap, what do you call a gapless?
That's gapless. So in one dimension, if you're at a controlled invariant critical point in one dimension, the entropy will go logarithmically in the length. So you don't have that.
In two dimensions, however, if you just look at the entanglement entropy, it's ultraviolet divergence. And so even if the theory is gapless, the entropy still obeys an area law because it's dominated solely by the short distance, and even more so in more than two dimensions. So the two things to be aware of. First, the entropy in more than one dimension, the entropy, especially these Rainy entropies, will be an interesting quantity to talk about because we can directly relate those to the matrix product state representation. In higher dimensions, even if you know that the entropy is small, that doesn't mean you know that there's a good matrix product state representation. The other thing is a lot of those theories, those critical conformally invariant theories, are much better behaved than certain other ones. There do exist, for example, free fermions in 2D don't obey an area law. They're not actually conformally invariant. They don't obey an area law in 2D. So some of those theories are sort of better behaved than you would expect. I mean, it's interesting also that there are cases that are better behaved than you expect. But there are also counterexamples to thinking that it's always going to be that good.
Are you saying that this entanglement entropy for a 2 plus 1 dimensional black hole would not obey an area law?
I
took into account that there were free fermions.
Free non-relativistic fermions, which have a Fermi surface. I'm a kinetic matter theorist, so when I say fermions, I mean things with Fermi surface. You're thinking of, like, as a kinetic matter theorist, you're thinking of, like, graphene, which has Fermi points, or Dirac fermions. Those would obey an area law. But things with a Fermi surface don't obey an area law in 2 plus 1 dimensions.
But if the non-interacting doesn't obey an area law, interaction will just make things worse.
Some cases yes, some cases no. We have very little control in more than one dimension about what happens to the entanglement entropy. There's really not much known about the entanglement entropy more than 1D for general theories. Okay, so I'm going to give a very brief sketched proof of how one goes about proving the area law in more than 1D. So this will be sort of fairly mathematical interlude. Ashwin wanted to see this at least, so hopefully at least one person will like this. So this is the brief statement of what the theorem is. The assumptions go in, let's say you have a nearest neighbor Hamiltonian, or more generally any finite range Hamiltonian. You have some bounded interaction strength. So the terms in the Hamiltonian that can connect neighboring sites are bounded in terms of how their strength. You have a finite dimensional Hilbert space on each site. You have a unique ground state, and you have a spectral gap delta E. Then you can prove that the entropy across any cut in the system is bounded by some S max, which is exponentially large in 1 over delta E. It's actually exponentially large in this velocity V. This is called the Lieb-Robinson velocity. It's a measure of how fast influences can propagate in the system. And it's of order this interaction constant J. So it's exponentially large in this ratio. Before I go on, let me mention it's not quite clear whether this is a good bound or not, in that for conformally invariant systems, it only diverges as log 1 over the energy rather than exponentially. On the other hand, Daniel and I have been working out some examples that show you can at least get systems with entanglement that's much larger than log in 1 over the entropy, but still only going as a power of 1 over the energy. The question is just how much entanglement you can get in a system with a gap. Is this bound just still fairly loose, or have we not yet really thought of the right systems? So here's the sketched proof of this. Suppose you don't have this bound on the entanglement entropy. So suppose there's a cut where this entanglement entropy bound is violated. Then that would mean that actually there's a range of places I can cut the chain where the entropy is large, simply because if the entropy is large across a given cut, it's at least that minus log d across one cut over that minus 2 log d, two cuts over, and so on. The entropy can't change too much. And so let's get a length scale L naught, which will be this S max over 3 log d. And all the way along there, the entropy would be at least 2/3 this S max. So you'd have a range of cuts with a large entanglement entropy. And I'm going to derive a contradiction from this based on locality properties of the Hamiltonian relative entropy. Let me define S sub L to be the entanglement entropy of an interval of length L contained within this long range here. So it's the maximum entanglement entropy of a small length of length L
with the rest of the chain that's contained in this whole link. Some trivial properties. S sub 1 is at most log d, because there are at most d different states on a site. So the entropy is at most log d. Next, S sub 2L is at most 2S sub L. The entropy of two intervals put together is at most twice the entropy of a single interval. This is called subadditivity. Now, let me suppose that this second inequality is saturated. Suppose S sub 2L were exactly equal to 2S sub L. This is not something that can happen. If this saturated, what this implies is that the density matrix on this interval of twice the length between I and I plus 2L would exactly factorize into two different density matrices. So if here's these two intervals of length L, if the entropy of the whole thing is exactly equal to this entropy plus this entropy, it means there are no correlations between the two of them. And so the density matrix exactly factorizes. And this is something you can prove using the idea of relative entropy. This would mean, though, that remember the Hamiltonian is nearest neighbor. So I have these two intervals. The only term in the Hamiltonian that goes across from the left side to the right side is right here. But there are no correlations between them. This means that I could take the ground state and just write it as some factorized state on the left side times some factorized state on the right side. What I mean by this is, so let's say, again going back to this picture, this was the interval of length little l. This was the other interval of length little l. And here's the whole left-hand side of the chain. Here's the whole right-hand side of the chain. Let's write down a trial density matrix, which is the reduced density matrix of the ground state on the left-hand side times the reduced density matrix of the ground state on the right-hand side. This matrix, this state, has no entanglement across the cut. It's a product state. On the other hand, if you compute the expectation value of any of these nearest neighbor Hamiltonians, you find that it's the same as in the ground state, because the things acting on the left-hand side see the same density matrix as in the ground state. Things on the right-hand side see the same density matrix as in the ground state. And there are no correlations across here, so they don't care that I just factorized the state across that cut. So in fact, this second inequality cannot be saturated, because by assumption, the ground state had lots of entanglement across this cut. So in fact, this has got to be a less than in this case. I'm going to go further and use the fact that not only is it entangled across the cut, but it's entangled by a lot across the cut to succeed in showing that S of 2L is at most 2S of L minus something that grows linearly in L. And given this result, what you can do is you can keep iterating this, starting with this initial condition that S sub 1 is at most log d. You can get a bound S sub 2 is at most 2 log d minus something. S sub 4 is at most 4 log d minus something a little bigger. And you'll find that the entropy would go negative at some point. And that would give you a contradiction. So this is the key thing to show, that in order for there to be this large entanglement across the cut, there actually have to be lots of correlations nearby so that this S sub 2L is a fair amount less than 2S sub L. So two lemmas. First, given all those assumptions above, I can define some Hermitian positive definite operators, OB, OL, and OR, where B is supported near the boundary between these cuts, L is supported all the way on the left-hand side of the system, OR is supported all the way on the right-hand side of the system. And this product, OB, OL, OR, is a good approximation to the projection operator onto the ground state. What do I mean by a good approximation? Well, I have these two indices, J and L. J is just where I put the cut between L and R, and between the left and the right-hand side. And this index L is how wide this operator OB is that connects the two halves. And when I say it's good approximation, it's an error that's exponentially small in L. So what you have here is I have some operator that gets the right state on the correct state on the left-hand side, some operator that gets the correct state on the right-hand side, and some operator that stitches them together in the middle. And the bigger I make that operator in the middle, the closer this whole thing becomes to being the actual projector onto the ground state. I'm not going to prove this. This is something that you use these Lieb-Robinson velocities, so bounds on the velocity of the propagation in the system, to show. But one can show that. The next part. The next statement I'm going to show, and this one I will show, or sketch, is that given all those same assumptions above, and suppose there's some factorized density matrix such that it has its expectation value in the ground state is some p, which is greater than 0. So that's the probability that the ground state is actually in this factorized state. Then I claim that the entropy across the cut is bounded by, the important term is this one, it's something that goes as log 1 over p. And then some stuff that depends upon the spectral gap and so on, something that depends upon the spectral gap and the log of the Hilbert space dimension. So what this tells you is that if you can find a factorized state that has a large p, that when you compute its expectation value in the ground state, it has a large p, then that means the entropy across the cut isn't too big. And the way you prove this is that you use this previous lemma, lemma one. You say, OK, I'm going to take the state rho, and I kind of bootstrap it into a better and better state. I take these operators OB, OL, and OR, which give a good approximation to the ground state, and I act on it. I act on the state rho with these two operators. The resulting state will be closer to the ground state. This state rho had a projection onto the ground state that was p, but when I act on it with these operators, its projection onto the ground state will be a little bit bigger than p. It'll be larger. It'll be an improved state. And I can consider larger and larger L, and I can see that I get better and better approximations to the ground state by looking at these states. Now, these states are all entangled across the cut, because this operator OB mixes across the cut. But this state here has a Schmidt rank that's at most d to the 2L, because the operator OB only mixes within a certain distance across the cut. And by doing that, you can use it to show how quickly the Schmidt coefficients in the ground state must decay, because by taking larger and larger L, I can get better and better approximations to the ground state. So there's that. This lemma, too, also works to bound the Rényi entropies, and it works to bound the ability to approximate the ground state by the matrix product state, because it actually shows you how quickly the Schmidt coefficients decay. So you have a relationship between all these things. If you knew the von Neumann entropy, you could use this lemma to tell you something about how the Rényi entropy decayed, something about the ability to approximate the ground state by a matrix product state. So all these things would be connected by this one result. So here's the back to the main theorem. The expectation value of this operator OB in the ground state better be close to unity. And the reason for that is that this product of these operators, OB, OL, and OR, when it acts on the ground state, it gives back almost exactly the ground state. Each of these operators has norm at most one, so each of them better give back something close to the ground state. They're all Hermitian positive definite norm at most one. So this has to be quite large, this expectation of OB. On the other hand, this expectation of OB is the same as the expectation in the reduced density matrix along this subchain. That's what I've written here. At the same time, though, the expectation of this OB, if I take not this reduced density matrix, but this factorized density matrix, this better be small. And the reason this better be small is that suppose it weren't small. Suppose the expectation value of that OB were not small in the factorized state. Then I would claim that that factorized state would be close to the ground state, because OL sees only the left-hand side of that factorized state, so it's happy. OR sees only the right-hand side, so it's happy. And if OB also had a high expectation value, then this factorized state would be close to the ground state. And it can't, because of this previous discussion that if a factorized state is close to the ground state, you have small entropy. So that means I've found an operator OB here that distinguishes very well between the factorized state and the unfactorized state. In one case, it has an expectation value close to 1. The other case, it has an expectation close to 0. This tells you something about the states being different. You can use the Lindblad-Ullmann theorem to quantify the relative entropy, to mathematically quantify that the states are different. And this gives you some bound on the difference between the entropies. And after putting in all the constants, you get the desired result for the area law. So that's a very quick sketch of how this works. But the key ingredients of this are really these velocities, these finite velocity in the system that lets you write down these approximate operators. And the result is that as soon as you know you have the spectral gap, you know that you have a bound on the amount of entanglements in these one-dimensional systems. I admit, a very roundabout way of proving the desired result. OK, so now what this lets you say is it lets you say that these problems are in NP, at least if you ask the right question about them. Because I can represent the ground state of these systems as a matrix product state. The size of the ground state is roughly, this k is roughly going to be exponential in this entropy S. And if you want to better approximate the ground state, so I said k is roughly this entropy S for the ground state. Suppose you want a better approximation. You increase k by a small amount. This theorem also tells you that the error you make will go down polynomially with the size of k, so that the bigger you make k, the closer you can get to the ground state. This gives you a good ability to represent the ground state, and it gives you a good way of checking the existence of the ground state in these systems. Someone can now give you, as a proof of the ground state in these systems, they can give you a low rank matrix product state and say, measure the energy on this thing. And that's something you can do efficiently. The time to compute things in these matrix product states is only a polynomial in k. you can do that. And people do it all the time. It's called this density matrix renormalization group. It's an extremely powerful tool used very, very widely used in this field. Actually, in practice, I said it goes down polynomial in K. In practice, it goes down a lot faster than that. But that's currently what the bound is. However, then you may ask, how hard is it to actually find this state? I said that there does exist this matrix product state representation of the ground state. You can ask, how hard is it to go find the matrix product state approximation of the ground state? So Jens Isaert showed that if you fix certain of these matrices A, and then you ask the problem of finding the minimum over the other matrices A, minimizing the ground state energy over the other matrices A, that that problem is NP complete, so that that problem is hard. It's not really clear to me that Jens then showed that the actual problem of minimizing over all of them is hard, because he fixed certain ones and then said you get to vary over certain other ones. But he showed that that problem was NP complete. And in practice, well, in practice, depends upon the system. For systems like just a spin one chain, it's pretty easy to find the right choice of these matrices. For other problems, like problems with polarons, you have to be careful about how you warm up. And so you are able to find the right ground state, but you can also get trapped in false minimum. If you make a poor choice of the matrices A, you can get trapped in a false minimum. As usually what the algorithms do is they just improve one of these matrices at a time. And I say in practice they work pretty well. So now I'm just going to mention very briefly this last problem. So suppose there is no gap in one dimension. So how hard is it going to be to compute the ground state energy? If the gap vanishes at a system described by conformal field theory, for example, a Heisenberg spin chain or interacting fermions in a Hubbard model in one dimension or something like that, then the entropy, all the entropies, the von Neumann entropy, the Rainey entropy, all these only go logarithmically at most in the length of the chain. So you don't have too much entanglement in the ground state. And this means that the problem is still in P. The problem is still in P because the cost that you have to do to find the, I should say it's still in NP, not in P. Sorry about that. The problem is still in NP because you can do this thing in a polynomial time. The cost is exponentially large in the entropy. The entropy is only logarithmically large in the system. So the effort you have to put out is only polynomial in the system size. So it's not too bad. You can actually do all these systems very well. Transverse field Ising model, that's another example that I've written down there. So there's a lot of systems where you can do very well with this simply because the entropy is not very big. But suppose you consider a one-dimensional spin chain with arbitrary interactions. So this is these recent results I mentioned of Aharonov, Daniel Gottesman in the audience, and Julia Kempe, and then independently Sandy Arani. Then the problem is QMA complete of approximating ground state energy to a certain accuracy. And then there is probably no hope of an efficient algorithm. So a lot of these problems in practice with no gap are easy, but some of them are hard. Quantum Merlin Arthur. So this is the problem I mentioned at the beginning, where you can verify the state if you have a quantum computer. So, and the prototypical problem is, does there exist an interface state of this quantum? So I put the circular shape plus. One can ask about other methods. People have studied a lot of other methods in practice. A lot of these methods that condensed matter physicists use work extremely well for certain problems, but not for certain other problems. So for example, quantum Monte Carlo, if the system doesn't have a sign problem, works very well for problems in any dimension, lets you do extremely large lattices, but only certain Hamiltonians without a sign problem. Density functional theory. There's this Hohenberg-Cohen theorem that implies that there's this exact density functional. And that's always used to justify why density functional theory works. But the problem is that this exact functional is almost certainly not tractable. And really, they do well because in practice, the density functional is well approximated by a fairly tractable one on the systems that they study. So let me conclude. We have a range of different problems. The difficulty of solving them is closely related to the entanglement in these problems, especially in these matrix product state representations. Then one of the questions I think is an interesting question is whether this area law bound on the entropy is tight, in that IE gave a bound back there that it diverged exponentially as 1 over the gap. This seems too fast. This seems like this is a large amount, and that in reality there should be a rigorous bound that would be a lot smaller. I don't know. it's an open question. As I said, we have some interesting counterexamples to conjectures of bounds that are much tighter, but we still have a large gap between where we know we can get the entropy to for a given gap and where we can prove that the entropy is at most. Another question is, what happens in higher dimensions? In many cases, the actual entropy is very well behaved in higher dimensions, but I don't have a general way of proving area law just off of a spectral gap in higher dimensions. And also, there are other questions in that, well, in 1D, if you have a bound on the entropy, at least if you have a bound on the Rainey entropies, you know you can represent the ground state by a matrix product state. In higher dimensions, even if you have a bound on the entropy, you don't have a good notion of whether you can represent the state by a matrix product state or a higher dimensional tensor product state. And even if you did, a lot of these states are not tractable in higher dimensions. In one dimension, given this matrix product state, to compute expectation values is just multiplying matrices. In higher dimensions, it's very hard. So we can ask whether there are other better algorithms. But I will stop here. Thanks.
Something very simple. In your bound with the exponent, there's no trace of the shape of the size of the system.
So this is a one-dimensional system, but there's no threat. But there's no importance to the size of the region, and that's why there's an interesting bound that it's independent of all the sizes.
You mentioned kind of a faster approach to using this perturbation theory.
Yeah.
Could you say a bit more about
that? Yeah, okay. So this is interesting because the first way that someone proved that perturbation theory for any problem was something you could do in polynomial time is actually basically a version of the coupled cluster approach. They used a perturbative solution of those equations to show that you could quickly compute the perturbation coefficients. Because otherwise,
you automatically sum certain diagrams to infinite order.
Right. So they actually were only concerned with summing over up to a finite order, and they were interested in the fact that those coupled cluster equations give you a good method of extracting things up to a finite order. So, for example, if you used Feynman diagrams to compute the perturbation theory, the cost will go up faster than exponentially in the order you're looking at. It will go up factorially in the order of perturbation theory, which is too fast to get something that will be polynomial in the error. So they just use coupled cluster, and this I find very interesting, as a way of efficiently summing low order terms. We don't know any good results about what happens yet in infinite order of coupled cluster. So I think it's an interesting question.
But there's been applications.
Certainly in practice, it's been a very powerful.
Might there be some connection between the problems where we find it hard to find the ground state and where nature finds it hard? And for example, in a glass, I don't know that this would apply, but something along those lines.
Perhaps. I mean, you know, so in the classical problems, there is systems which are glassy for which we can still find the ground state efficiently. The question is whether nature, who has more limited dynamics, can find the ground state efficiently or not. Of course, nature runs the dynamics much faster, but whether they can still find the ground state efficiently or not. So for example, a lot of systems in two dimensions, certain systems in two dimensions, you can efficiently find the ground state even though the system is still glassy. In the quantum case, In the quantum case, you can ask, whether it will be hard. And certainly, I think that for the problems which are in this QMA complete class, there will be realizations for which nature will be unable to find the ground state efficiently. I think in many ways, though, nature will be giving us problems which are a little bit easier, in the sense that if we look at a Hubbard model or something like that, which has periodic translationally invariant interactions, then there can be frustration, but there isn't this disorder, so the problem should be easier in many ways. We don't see why that should be as hard. Certainly in the classical case, this would all be easier. If you look at a random system, nature certainly gives us random systems where there's disorder. In any of the high TCs, there's a lot of disorder in real physical samples. Often disorder, at least in one dimension, disorder will often localize the propagation of excitations and may make the system easier.
So it's not clear whether nature would ever actually be able to present us with one of these very hard instances, at least in one dimension. Or in higher dimensions, perhaps we can get presented with one of these hard instances. But in 1D, I don't think we can really get presented with such a hard instance. I don't know if that answers the question.
Why is it hard to be at a low in higher dimension?
So the bound is, it's one of those hard questions to answer. Why is it hard to do something? In higher dimensions, we don't have such a nice decomposition into different pieces of the chain. If I follow this machinery, I will succeed in proving that the entropy only depends upon boundary properties, but I'll succeed if it goes as the exponential of the boundary area, which is then going to be worse than the line. So I suppose it's vaguely interesting, but that it only depends upon the boundary, but it would be exponential in the boundary area. So I think really the problem is just that the bound is super loose in 1D, and that's why it won't become worse in higher dimensions. And then the other issue is, given an area law, we don't know what the right order condition stays in higher dimensions. Given an area law in 1D implies that there's matrix product representation. Higher D, you don't know. You actually want more than an area law.
Yeah, just a question. For some of these problems, could you use bad answers? Because for Hubbard Hamiltonian, you can solve exactly the same equations the non-dimensional. The problem there is, I suppose, that you get energies and you can't get wave functions.
Okay, so a lot of problems in 1D, you have exact solutions, but then there's a lot where you don't. I mean, so if you have spinful fermions, you're not going to have an exact solution of that. See, a lot of people don't have exact solutions. I think the nice thing about a lot of these methods is that in 1D, that they don't rely so much on the exact solubility of the problem. So the history of DMRG, for example, as I understand it, is that people had tried various kinds of renormalization groups for quantum ground states in 1D. The problem that there was put out was, they couldn't even do a particle in a box. That's just a single particle in a box. The problem put out, if you can do that, then there's something. And DMRG was the first one to do that, and then it just works so well on all these other things. So I think the nice thing is that these methods don't really know much about the integrability of the system, that they don't rely on it. But one certainly uses the integrability as a check on these methods, as a check, because then you have a point you can check against exactly.
Can I ask a question that's a bit maybe naive, but at the very beginning of your talk, you said that diagonalization is sort of brute force approach. That's actually what happens as you run out of space before you run out of time.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that actually makes sense formally, because is it not known that you can solve these problems in polynomial space?
It's that approach. Can you solve it? Well, so the existing methods of doing it are, the existing methods store the state vector. They don't store actually the Hamiltonian is sparse, the interaction is sparse. So they get a sparse representation of the Hamiltonian, and they store the state vector itself, and then they do line choice iteration. So that takes multiple rounds of that to find the ground state. And no method that I know of to do it. So yeah, even if there were a way, I suppose that raises the possibility that if you had a way of doing it in less space but more time, it might be useful. Certainly, though, if it starts to take exponential time, then that would be a problem. But space gets to be the trade-off.
Well, complexity theoretically, space is much smaller complexity cost. Exponential time, even
right.
Though it's there, none of them active.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if there's sort of a formal way of trading off one for the other in this problem, but certainly in practice, there are some people know you can answer the actual practical issues better than I do, but I guess in practice it's like a couple of days of CPU time on one machine, but buy another 32 gigs of memory and you'll get one more site. So everyone spent 64 gigs to another thing, you just double the memory every time you want to buy one more site. So. So you run out of space, and you can't access, you can't go to disk, because if you go to disk, it'll just too much. So space is the issue. But I don't know about a complexity theory version.
have your methods for getting at an area loss been applied yet to standard model type relativistic quantum field theories in the ultraviolet cutoff that is allowed?
So currently, I mean, everything I've been able to do with these kind of stuff is in 1B. So these would, of course, be one-dimensional quantum field theories. But if you do such field theories in 1D, a lot of these things you can write down a lattice and then find the appropriate regularization. The only kind of technical issue you run into is, for example, if you have a lot of these things rely on having bounded operator norm for the interaction. So even if you had, say, just talking about a condensed matter analog, if you had just bosons operating in one dimension, then if you can have an unbounded number of bosons on site, then the interaction constants, there's no bound on the interaction strength. And then in term like phi dagger phi, they become arbitrarily large. I think that's primarily a technical issue within the condensed matter side. One can, I think, deal with that. Now, the question is, for the kind of stuff you're talking about, when you go to the right regularization, is there going to come in some additional unboundedness that I can't deal with? I don't think so, but I haven't gone through it in any detail.
I think that in quantum field theory, the area law has been proved on the basis of Lorentz invariance of the vacuum and strong subadditivity by Cassini.
This is in 1D.
Just in 1D.
I think it's just in 1D. I think this is just in 1D. But in any event, I mean, this is, in any event, also, as you mentioned, you have Lorentz invariance, which.
Yeah.
So we have all these systems which have emergence Lorentz invariance in condensed matter, but we're also interested in the lattice systems which don't have it. That's an interesting thing. I was looking at some of this in 1D because then they were also speculative about versions of central charge in more than one dimension, which would be related to entanglement, whether there's an entanglement version of it in more than 1D. And then I was wondering whether there would be a lattice version of that also. So,